Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is Friday. It is May 1st. It is May Day. And just 3 days away from May the 4th be with you. I had to slip that in there. It's because it is Friday and it's true crime. I have Jen with me. Jen, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Good. I'm hanging in there. I have lost track of the number of days that I've been inside, which is a good thing, I guess, or, you know, time has no meaning. I'm grateful that I'm safe, and I'm grateful that you're safe. I really like this case that we started last week. I can't believe it's May already, but in a way I can, because March and April seem like they each took a year.
It's like we're on island time. You know, I'm not mad about that. I'm just glad that we're healthy, and I hope that everyone that's listening is healthy.
Yes, and everyone, I know it's hard, but, you know, stay inside at least as much as you can. Anyway, last week we were talking about this murder, but we actually never got around to the murder part yet, and we may or may not get to the murder of Roy Raden today, but we're going to talk about Roy. But when we last started when we left off, we'd been talking about Adnan Khashoggi and kind of all the evil that he had got up to in the world, and how the Iran-Contra mess, and how he can be kind of tied into Southern Air Transport, which ties into Epstein, which ties into Wexner. And then, you know, this relationship where Evans said that, you know, he liked Adnan to finance the movies, but he didn't want him to finance this one because it was going to be too big of a deal. But something that Jen found, which I found really, really interesting, and which kind of plays into what we're going to talk about today, is in March of 1981, Evans, and this is from New York Magazine. In March of 1981, Evans encountered a young actress named Melissa Prophet on a flight to New York. She's a former Miss California, and she had appeared as a tennis groupie in the movie Players. And she had become friendly with Adnan Khashoggi, the Arab arms dealer. He had offered to help her finance a film. She remembers, AK said, "Well, Melissa, let us produce a movie for you." I said, "Great." And now, as Evans told her back, Prophet said it was like a scene in a movie. And it just kind of crazy. It said that as Evans flew to New York on the private 727, a woman he describes as an extraordinarily beautiful girl served him champagne. The woman then changed into a negligee, Evans remembers. She yawns and says, "Let's go to bed." I say, "Good night." She says, "Aren't you going to come in?" And my legs are shaking. I say, "No." After Evans landed, Prophet called and said she had listened to a recording of the conversation on the plane. So this is interesting. You have this conversation on the plane. You have, just like you said last week, Jen, Adnan, Epstein, this whole group, it's all about blackmail.
Oh yeah, this is classic Khashoggi, you know, all day long. You have to watch them anytime you're around them.
He gets you on a 727. And folks, if you're listening to this, this is exactly House on St. Charles. Exactly. This is what they do. They record, they blackmail. That's how they control you. And that's what Khashoggi was doing. And this Prophet, she says, I listened to a recording of the conversation on the plane. And then she said, AK is so clever. So then you have, and this is about the Cotton Club too. So it says, just as Khashoggi had predicted, Evans returned to Las Vegas a few days later. In an agreement dated April 30th, 1981, Khashoggi pledged to invest $2 million in the Cotton Club. And Evans was bound to keep this agreement confidential and disclose this investment or the identity of the investor to no person. And Evans was required to give Melissa Prophet screen credit as associate producer. This is just somebody that Adnan wanted to have sex with and then says, "Here, I'll make you an associate producer on this big movie." So then the way this goes is with this money, Evans then brought in Mario Puzo. He's the guy who wrote The Godfather, and he wanted him to come in and write the script. And then so Khashoggi threw a party for Puzo and Evans at the Dunes Hotel. There was 30 violinists. They played the theme from The Godfather. Then later Khashoggi pushed a button and a wall slid open to reveal a private casino. Evans took a stack of chips from his host and later split 20 grand in winnings with Puzo. And Khashoggi dropped $250,000 on a single roll of the dice.
Yeah, pocket change.
It is. And then where we have Evans and why we are bringing in Lainey and this Roy Raiden is in the morning, Khashoggi appeared in a caftan and said that he was willing to put $10 million more into the picture. Khashoggi then assigned his brother Essam to work out the details, and a few days later, the deal fell through. So that's where we, that's Khashoggi, and that's kind of when people talk about the house in St. Charles, and I told you the people who run it, and it's the same people that run with Adnan. It's the same kind of people that run with Epstein. It's the same kind of thing that Guy Lane and Guy Lane's dad did. There's a certain segment of the population that makes a ton of money by blackmailing you and, you know, getting you out of trouble when you need to get out of trouble, making a really great plea bargain deal when you need to get out of trouble.
That's true. These people know what they're doing. You have to watch them with the mirrors, and anytime that you are around them, you might as well think that you're being recorded, and they will leverage that against you later.
Then you have Roy. And honest to goodness, until we did this, Jen, I had never heard of the guy, and I'm kind of surprised I've never heard of him until we started doing this. Because he is just, I mean, he was an entertainer. He was in vaudeville. He definitely had ties to a lot of, you know, entertainment kind of people. And then he threw sex parties, bondage parties. So you would think that I would have heard of him, but I hadn't.
And see, that's where I had heard of him, was the sex parties and the thing with the actress. I'd never heard about him being involved in the cold-blooded movie finance.
Is it Mallory Haller or Melanie? I can't even remember now. So you have this woman, she's a Playboy bunny, wannabe actress kind of thing.
That's going to be Melanie.
Melanie, thank you. And it's spelled funny too. It's like M-E-L-O-N-I-E or something. That's kind of the introduction really to the world that, where we get of Roy Raiden is this, what happened in April 12th, 13th, 1980. You have Roy. He's got this massive place in Southampton, right? It's so big that I read some story where the previous owner had all their windows smashed or something, and there's 1,300 windows.
Yeah, this is like a big, gaudy mansion. That's how it's normally described. And he had parties that were just so significantly large, he'd have the police force actually on his payroll, and they would direct traffic to make sure that all these different elite men would have good parking spaces if they were going to go to a Raiden party. And considering what was going on inside, does that not blow your mind?
It totally blows my mind. And there is a great, I'm not going to go into it in great, in this super great detail, but if you guys are interested, there is, New York Magazine back in when all this happened, they wrote, an article called Melanie Haller's Lost Weekend. And it talks about how Southampton and the Hamptons, where we all think, you know, everybody's kind of hoity-toity, and how there was this hoity-toity kind of thing, this blue bloodness. But at the same time, it talks about how that kind of all these house parties, people would make excuses. Oh, I have to go home. I have to do this today. I have to do this tonight. Sorry, we're going to be up early. And all these people would leave these hoity-toity blue blood parties and then go over to Roy Raiden's house.
Yeah, where he had the video sex tape parties.
Exactly. Again, with the video. And what he's videotaping is a lot of these men in these very, very compromising positions. And there's also some of the Hamptons women that are involved. And, of course, they are being recorded, too. But this all kind of went on behind the scenes. Like, everybody knew, but nobody talked about it. And I think it was a secret that the Hamptons crowd wanted kept quiet. But
it's kind of like a Hamptons version of Eyes Wide Shut.
I would say it's even more extreme than that, probably.
You're probably right.
But so Melanie kind of blew the entire lid off of this thing and set in motion Roy meeting Robert Evans and all this kind of stuff. So Melanie goes to this dinner party at Roy's house, and he is a film producer. And Haller had been introduced to Roy by a photographer and visited Roy's home hoping to kind of forward her acting career. She seemed to, she had made the rounds in LA and didn't catch on anywhere and was back in New York. Well, the day after the party, Haller was discovered on a commuter train to Manhattan, unconscious and bloodied. It is because they put her on a train rather than springing for the $60 for a limo that all of this blew up. I'm not sure why multimillionaires didn't want to spring for the $60. They actually put her in their car, dumped her on a train, and then left. Which I, you know, maybe they were drunk and they thought it was a good idea. I'm not sure what they were thinking.
Yeah, that or they just degrade women and kick them to the side, because it's pretty much what I read. They didn't really care about these people, which is sad.
It is sad. And Melanie also had done Playboy. She was a centerfold one month. I remember that. But she claimed to have been beaten and raped during the party at Raiden's home, and then further alleged that the crimes had been filmed by Raiden and or others in attendance. And then Raiden claims that Haller had consented to sexual games during the party. Well, you know, the New York City press was just all over this kind of thing. Because, I mean, come on, it's your shot. You get your shot at, you know, screwing over the Hamptons crowd and, you know, what's sex and, you know, violence and, just videotapes.
And then the back end of it is, if they don't want you to write about it, then you are now in a position to kind of blackmail them and say, hey, you know, if you don't want this to appear in the tabloid section, then pay us some money, because that was going on too.
So, you know, they covered it. And then in 1981, on this guy named Robert McKeege the IV, who was kind of Haller's sugar daddy, for a better choice of words, he pleaded guilty to assaulting Melanie and was sentenced to 30 days in jail. I don't think that anything happened to Roy Raiden for that. Am I right on that?
He was brought up on some weapons charges, and then they dropped all the other petty charges underneath that because he rolled on the guy who actually assaulted her.
And when you think about all of these sex parties and the Hamptons, there's a lot that goes back in time, and there's, you know, last time we connected all the dots with certain things with Khashoggi. And, you know, one of the things that you have to also connect the dots with Evans is that, you know, he was a key figure in Heidi Fleiss's, you know, hooker ring, for lack of a better term. He was kind of something of a boyfriend to Heidi. And then he introduced Heidi to this guy named Thomas Corbally. And some of you are going, who the heck is Thomas Corbally? Why has any of this come? Thomas Corbally was the fixer for Roy Cohn. He was a fixer for Donald Trump. And he was kind of, you know, just everybody's go-to when you needed something done in the Hamptons kind of thing. And, you know, in New York. And this was kind of during the early 1990s. But where Evans and Corbally had got to know each other is during the Cotton Club project, and maybe even further back, maybe back to The Godfather in Chinatown, but definitely around the same time as the whole Cotton Club thing. And it's just this continuous line, right? From, you know, you have Roy Raiden and you have Lainey and you have these prostitution rings and you have these sex games and you have this, the New York upper crust elite all involved in these kind of things, and they were trying to keep it quiet. And then by dumping, you know, Melanie on a train, it kind of blew everything up. It's just amazing to me where you see all of these different people, and you have Heidi Fleiss, Robert Evans, you know, Thomas Corbally, and all these kind of things.
And then we can't forget the fact that Robert Evans produced Rosemary's Baby, and in the background you've got Roman Polanski still running around, so he had formed a relationship with him.
And, you know, and all of the underage people in that crowd,
And you know what's interesting? So not only did he know Melissa Prophet, who was Miss California, which they call her Little Miss Western Union since she was hooked up with Khashoggi, but Robert Evans was also dating, he married Phyllis George. She was Miss America 1971. How many times do we have beauty queens come up in these cases? Like Crystal Spencer, there was a beauty queen in that too.
I think it's because, especially with Miss America, it always had this certain cachet. And so you either married a beauty queen or you married somebody in Playboy. It seemed that was kind of where you went, I think, I married Miss America. Oh, I only married a Miss California, or something like that. And, but it seems as if when you won these beauty contests and all of a sudden you enter this different kind of world where you can meet a Khashoggi and where you're meeting Robert Evans. And, it just kind of interesting to me. And there was Corbally kind of opened the door, to what was going on in the Hamptons at the time, and where he was the one who was talking about the bondage and the whippings, and, that if you said that you had tennis elbow, what you really had was, something called thrasher's arm, where you had been, beating women or something and using a cane or whatever. And that's your tennis elbow if you got sore from that. And Corbally had photographs of, women and couples naked, getting candle wax dripped on them. There was this, gizmos that were invented that were, like metal and rubber tubing. And why did he want to share? He said that the whole scene was supposed to be fun and games, but amateurs wouldn't necessarily know where to draw those fine lines. You'll do something wrong and you'll end up in the headlines. And then he said that he had never accepted an invitation from Roy Radin. But he obviously knew Roy Radin, but he didn't want to associate with him because of the fact that he thought that they were amateurs. And if you go back and you read this New York Magazine thing, it seems that there were three homes in the Hamptons that were having these kind of parties, that you went to one of the three. So it sounds like Roy had it. Whoever Corbally was doing with him maybe had another party. And then Kubrick, like you said, with Eyes Wide Shut, he actually based the film on the insider knowledge that he had of what was going on in the Hamptons. And that there was some novel called, I'm never going to pronounce this, Traume Nouvelle, by this Austrian writer named Arthur Schnitzler. And there's this kind of, he kind of stayed, faithful to that plot line. But the fact that he had this insider knowledge, that's why he relocated the film to New York City and the surrounding area. And remember the infamous sex party that's in the movie takes place at an isolated country mansion outside of the city and features several other elements present in this Radin kind of circle, including the Mass and S&M. And then you had one of these other circles. One of these homes also, I think, was owned by a guy named Stephen Ward. And it's reputed that Ward's women also worked out of New York City in the 1960s. Maybe they were servicing JFK, and that Kubrick was well aware of this history and then had picked the New York setting with it. And Thomas Corbally, what's his history? He's a former OSS guy, CIA, private detective to the stars, and he was also known as a blackmail specialist extraordinaire. So this kind of thing's been going on a long, long time. And it's amazing to me.
How Kubrick ends up, it doesn't end well for him. He ends up getting basically knocked off. And then you have what's new in the news right now is that JFK, there's some files that were released talking about how he was worried about his indiscretions being released. So think about everything that you're saying and then how much truth there is to it because of all this stuff that's coming out that supports it.
Yeah, when we decided to do this just you know, it was a guy who was murdered. You know, it's, if you just say, oh, Roy Raden, he was murdered because somebody was jealous because they wanted to finance Robert Evans' movie. It could be one line. And then.
But when you start digging, these people are so connected.
And everything is just completely connected. And there was somebody that managed to make a link of Roy to the Son of Sam cult, which, you know, and he made his money. Roy made his money by doing, like I said, these vaudeville shows. And he would do these oldies kind of music tours. And he would get these police benevolent unions to kind of sponsor them. And then they were supposed to share the profits 50-50, but he often screwed them over. And there were some records that say that he ended up really only ever giving them about 27%, and he was keeping 73%. And that's how he essentially, you know, made all his money. His house out in Southampton was called Ocean Castle.
Yeah, they tried to pursue him and come back for the money, but they could never get him because it wasn't labeled under charity. So he was able to wiggle the profits out. And also, like, the guy was making so much money, he ends up giving up the whole vaudeville business, and he takes on the side hustle as his main hustle, which is this whole, the drugs, the blackmail, the police stuff, and all that. And, I mean, he's making a killing doing this stuff.
Well, also, look, if you are blackmailing people with all of these videos that you're taking, and somebody goes, well, I'm going to go to the police. He goes, good luck with that.
Yeah, because the police are on the payroll.
Exactly.
You know, if he's paying their salary, why do they want to take him down? Because that's basically just taking money out of their own bank account. That's how you have to think about it.
Yeah. And the Southampton police force is not large. But the thing is he had police contacts everywhere because he made his money partnering with police organizations all over the country, which is the best thing that you can do if you're going to end up trying to blackmail people is, you know, you control the cops.
Absolutely.
Oh, and you know what? You know, you said Rosemary's Baby, directed by Roman Polanski, but Chinatown was too.
Yeah, it sure was. And the weird thing about Robert Evans in this whole thing with Raden is that Robert Evans was almost a victim of the Sharon Tate murders because Sharon Tate had invited him over to the house on the night that she was murdered for a dinner party. And he was like, no, I'm not feeling good. I don't think I'm going to go. If he had went, he would have been murdered also.
And then, of course, you had the Godfather director, Francis Ford Coppola. He went on to actually direct the Cotton Club that Evans makes with Raden's money. And it just kind of begs the question of how familiar Evans was with all of this network and how long the relationship had existed. So we get now, we're kind of back to where Evans is, you know, meeting Laney and all of this. And because Evans and Khashoggi had this falling out, so then Evans turns to Ed and Fred Dumani, who are brothers from Lebanon, and they owned a bunch of hotels and casinos in Vegas. And everything was great, and then they read a draft of Puzo's script, and they hated it, and so then they pulled, you know, all of their money and financing from it. So then you had Robert Evans essentially trying to find money to keep it going, and he sold all of his Paramount stock to pay his bills, and it just kind of became this obsession, and he would talk about it to everyone, including his chauffeur, Gary Keyes. And of course, we talked about last week that in March of 1983, Keyes drove Laney Jacobs up through the gates to Evans' house. Now, Evans said that he was not desperate to raise money, and that he had only met Laney as a favor to his chauffeur. Whatever.
I don't know if I believe that, because, I mean, he was setting her up for money, and the worst thing that he ever did was to get involved with Laney. Her own husband, one of her husbands, because she was married multiple times, he went to federal prison, and he actually said he was happy to be in there because it got him away from her. That's how dangerous she was. Her husband either ended up in prison or ended up dead.
Yeah, what was it last week? I think we said 7 times she got married or something like that. And Evan said, I'm very incident prone. I've had a great deal of things happen to me. Unfortunately, this was a disaster for me. He said that he found Laney to be a very sweet, quote, a very sweet, fun girl, woman, whatever you want to call her. She couldn't have been nicer, and she was very positive. And then he really liked the fact that her son was named Dax, and that he introduced her to his ex-wife to see if Allie McGraw wanted to have her eyes done to go to the same doctor, because he said did such a good job on Laney's or something like that. And so what it is, according to court testimony, Evans said that he kind of laid out his plan. He needed $35 million to finance three movies, The Cotton Club, The Two Jakes, and then the second sequel to The Godfather. And Laney said, well, I know somebody who might be interested. So she called a few days later and set up a meeting, and this guy came out, and it was Roy Rayton. I don't know. Do we know how? I don't even know if we know how Laney and Roy necessarily met, but I'm guessing that Laney provided, I mean, she knew everybody through her Coke sales, and it's just fascinating to me. I know we talked in part one, but Laney is this person who was just a regular 9-to-5-er. And yeah. Somehow,
until she hooked up with cocaine smugglers and realized that was a much better living, and she wanted a piece of that life. And once she got it, you know, you just keep building and building and building. You want to make more and more money. I tend to think that Roy Rayton met her through the cocaine dealing. I think she was supplying him drugs at some point.
I think you're 100% correct. And I think that, and then you also had Evans, even though he had been convicted of possession of coke, and he said that he wasn't using, all his friends at the time said that he was using even more. So, you know, the story about how Laney met him through the chauffeur, that could very well be, but the chauffeur might have said, you know, I've got some clients who need to buy some coke. And that's how they kind of met. So maybe, yes, they met through the chauffeur, but it wasn't about financing the movie. It was about, I need a new coke dealer or something like that. And here's Laney. So anyway, so Roy comes out, and I don't know if we've mentioned it, but Roy was a good sized man. About 300 pounds. He was only 33, but apparently the fact that he weighed so much, it made him seem super old. And Anna Montenegro, who we talked about in the first part, she was actually along with Laney the first time that she met Robert Evans. And Anna said that Rayton was a man with superhuman appetites. Quote, he would do 5 grams of coke in a day, then order Chinese food, asking for everything on the menu, and he'd eat it. Oh, by the way, this castle. Okay, so let's see. He bought his family a home in Hampton Bays on Long Island, but for himself, the castle that he bought was 77 rooms. So that's why it had 1,350 windows, probably. That's crazy. And apparently,
that is excessive.
You know, he had a fairly decent reputation. He was not a guy who was going out, and because he knew that he didn't really fit in. And one time he did go out to this party I read about in New York Magazine, where he actually went out with the Blue Bloods. And it's some party that they have every year where the quote unquote year rounders get together with the summer people. It's the one time they kind of mingle. And Roy showed up with 2 women. And they alternated flashing themselves to this crowd throughout the evening. So that was Roy's intro and exit to going to any kind of blue blood things. But he was, you know, he had this huge place. He was kind of at least tolerated because of his parties. But that whole Melanie Haller thing kind of, you know, ruined his reputation. And you were right. He was acquitted. He was actually acquitted of everything except carrying the concealed weapon. But I don't know if he went to jail or not. It doesn't really sound like it.
Yeah, I don't think so. He probably just got a slap on the wrist and paid his way out.
So then you have Robert Evans, and he says, now, my naivete was not checking him out and not checking her out. It was the only time in 25 years I didn't have a lawyer. But, you know, the reason why is probably because he was doing so many drugs, he didn't care. You know, this is a guy who's trying to raise $35 million while he's just ingesting coke like crazy and spending money, and he's selling stock to pay his bills and to pay for his coke use.
Yeah, him and Roy Rayton definitely were not in the right frame of mind to be doing any type of business, because Roy Rayton would have never gotten the limo that led him to his death if he had been, you know, logically in the right frame of mind.
So then you had, Evan said, if I had known Rayton was involved in this Melanie Haller thing in Long Island, I would have never met him. And then Evans also said that he had no idea that Laney was a drug dealer. No, if I had heard about it, I would have ran.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. He has some really good interviews. Like, I mean, I can't take away from the fact that some of his his producing is very well, but when he lies about something like that, it's not even believable. Like, he knew she was a drug dealer because obviously he was getting tons of coke from her, and he obviously knew that Roy Raden did drugs and also was into to bad stuff. They all had – they shared friends, so they knew about the sex parties and everything else.
And you also cannot convince me that Robert Evans, a man who is a producer, is probably always looking for movie ideas, didn't know, didn't see on the front page of New York papers, even in Los Angeles, about all of this that was going on in the Hamptons. Everybody must have been talking about it. It's on the front
because
page.
Allegedly, you know, you had Polanski that was maybe attending some of this stuff. So these people, they were friends. He had an ongoing relationship with Polanski. So, you know, they got on the phone and were like, hey, man, let's talk about these Hampton parties. These people all knew.
Of course they knew. So Raden and Laney, this is where they're kind of their partnership and then things go south. Because Raden wanted to move to Los Angeles because of what had happened in New York. He wanted to get into the movie business. He just wanted to be away from where he was front page news all the time. And so you have Raden, he comes out to Los Angeles, and they had an agreement. It was a two-page typed agreement that Laney and Raden would be 50-50 partners in any ventures that that they entered into, whether it was with Evans or anybody else. And Laney says that they both signed it, but her copy has mysteriously disappeared. And then Laney said that Anna was in the car that night when they were talking about this agreement, but Anna says she wasn't in the car and has no memory of a contract, but adds that Roy would have promised Laney anything to meet with Robert Evans. So you have Roy, who's really excited to be meeting with Robert Evans, because, I mean, the guy did win the Academy Award for The Godfather, for Chinatown, and now Raden has a chance to be in business with him. You know, of course, you know, he wants to do something like that. And so then they kind of, you know, put together this deal about this film company to make the three movies. Laney said that they never did cocaine in front of each other during business meetings at Robert Evans' home, but that each of us took long trips to the bathroom.
They had this very strange pact where you couldn't exactly be in the business because each of them, even though they did cocaine, she was a runner, but the other two thought they were some type of go-between, you know, to where they could get other people to buy drugs from them. So the rule is you can't use in deal because that never works out. So how they'd get around it was they just sneak off to the bathroom, pretend it didn't happen.
I know, right? It's just – so then Raden finds his banker friend who named Jose Alegria, who had devised a plan for raising $35 million in Puerto Rico. And then Roy calls Allegria at 3 o'clock in the morning to tell him, quote, I found the chance of a lifetime. And then Allegria testified that Raden had never mentioned Laney. He just said that he ran into Robert Evans in the Polo Lounge as if the two were old friends. So Roy is already, now that he's with Evans, is trying to kind of get Laney out of the way. But Laney doesn't know that Roy is doing that. So then she decided just to kind of leave the day-to-day business to Robert Evans and Roy Raden. But Laney being Laney, she started sleeping with Evans.
And he starts selling her more and more. And then she starts realizing, hey, I'm about to get cut out of this. Like this yeah. Roy Raden guy, he's coming for me. He's going to cut me out of this. I'm not going to get the kind of money I think I'm going to. And then she starts looking real hard at Raden, like, how can I get rid of you?
You know, so she, you know, she had this multi-million dollar production deal. And then also there's this unlimited supply of fresh off the boat Colombian cocaine. And so, you know, Evans is happy about that because, you know, he's not having to pay for it anymore because now he's got Laney, you know, shoveling coke, and there's going to be this deal. And so Evans sent bouquets of flowers regularly to Laney, of course, because he's getting free coke.
Oh, yeah, and he's getting the good stuff, the Colombian pure stuff.
And then you have Laney's courier, this guy that I mentioned in the first part, who would drive from Los Angeles to Miami, and he was that's all he did. Was couriered, you know, drugs one way and cash the other, just back and forth driving. And this guy's named Tally Rogers, and he moved into a room next to Roy at the Hollywood Regency Hotel, and the two became fast friends, and they shared coke and escorts. Boy, this is the 80s. This is Hollywood in the early 80s, and
So he was her chauffeur, right?
Okay, so Tally was the guy, the courier, the drug courier. So he would drive from L.A. To Miami to Lainey's partner in Miami. So the cash would go from L.A.
She would have been like his number one friend. So think about it. He's moving in now next door to Rory Raiden and supplying him with more coke and more escort. So he's probably getting more information out of him. She was kind of cornering him.
Yeah, because – and what happened is a couple of weeks before, so Lainey had fought really, really bitterly with Tally. And then the prosecution said that the fight was about Rogers wanting more than $20,000 a trip for driving drugs cross-country, which seems like a pretty good deal, but also maybe not a good deal. And Lainey said that it had nothing to do with money. She said that she didn't like him partying with an escort at Anna's Beverly Hills apartment, because what happened was the neighbor called the police. And apparently Rogers was also not just doing coke, he was also freebasing during this time. And so whatever kind of caution he had just kind of completely went out the window when he did that. So, you know, freebasing.
Yeah, that goes back to their thing about don't use if you're going to be running or dealing, because if you get messed up, you know, you get caught a lot quicker, and you know, they want to mitigate those kind of things that can happen.
And then the next thing you know, you're turning on everybody. So, yeah, if you're doing the drugs or whatever. So, of course, it was bad. So Anna actually saw the fight, and she said that Lainey was just frightening. And, of course, because Lainey's ordered people to be killed. She's done killings. She is cold-blooded. And she just – Anna said that, quote, she made mincemeat out of him. And then afterward, Anna – said that Lainey came outside like nothing had happened, as if we hadn't heard all the screaming. So then Lainey fired Rogers, threw him out of the apartment. But Rogers' wife started calling Lainey every day, begging her to give him one more chance. And Lainey said, I did, and quote, it was the biggest mistake I ever made. So then this brings us to 1983. And Lainey discovered that her garage safe had been emptied of its contents, 11 kilos of cocaine and 270 grand in cash. And only three people knew the combination. Lainey, Bella Chassis, but he's way back in Miami, and Rogers. So, you know, it's pretty obvious who did it. And the thing is that Lainey had just returned from a trip to Las Vegas with Rogers' wife. And the purpose of the trip was to cheer her up, because she was distraught over the state of her relationship with her husband, who was 20 years younger than she. And Lainey had lent her a dress. She paid for airfare, arranged for Caesar's Palace to, you know, give them free rooms. But there was some time during a morning that Betty fled the hotel, returned to Memphis. And she had testified that she received a phone call from her husband who instructed her to get out of Vegas in 30 minutes, warning, if you don't get out of there, you're going to be killed.
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants Lainey cozying up to them. You know, when you look at the list of people that have dropped dead around her, it's pretty lengthy.
So then Lainey returned home, and she gave this guy named Tim Whitehead, who was her other courier, a stack of kilos for weekly delivery. But when he arrived, he was met by a frantic Lainey. And where Lainey said that Tally had ripped her off and cleaned out the safe. So, of course, then you got to call your partner and say, hey, yeah, all these kilos of coke that you got from the Colombian sources on credit, it's all gone now. And the partner was, you know, obviously upset, because I mean, he's Colombian. They're going to come kill him. They're not going to go out there and kill Lainey, probably. But he said that Lainey needed to cover the loss. And if she didn't, then he was going to send the Colombians to her living room. And so then she called Betty and said, look, you know, you're going to pretend you don't know anything. All we want is just tell him to return the kilos and he can keep the cash. Because, you know, she needed the kilos so she could sell them so she wouldn't get killed. I mean, this is just kind of crazy. And just that all of this is going on while at the same time you're trying to finance a movie with Robert Evans and you have Roy Raden and all of this, but in the background, I mean, you can't even make, this is the movie that, that Robert Evans should have made, is, you know, about Lainey. And,
oh yeah, she would make a great movie.
And I mean, all of this that's going on, I mean, while it's just, if you made a movie about, you know, this scenario right here, nobody would believe that it actually happened. You have one of the biggest drug dealers in America financing this thing, getting robbed by a courier, and just all the partying and everything. It just, it almost this seems too cliche and stereotype, but.
Yeah, this is cinematic gold. Anyone that gets to play the role of Lainey is looking at an Academy Award nomination, if not probably winning, you know, if they pull it off. But just the whole thing, if it's put together correctly and someone can actually get in there and do it, because I heard it's really hard to sell this, to pitch it, that you kind of meet a lot of roadblocks.
So Lainey decides, because she needs to find him. She needs to find Rogers. And she needs to be protected herself. So she hires this guy who... a self-described private investigator. His name's Bill Mensur. And he had assembled essentially a bunch of bodyguards, including this guy named Mike Pascal, who told Lainey that he'd worked as a CIA operative to free the U.S. hostages in Iran. There was another veteran that was hired named Bob Lowe, who was rarely sober. There was a bodybuilder. There was another guy who was Argentinian who had worked as a bodyguard for Larry Flint of Hustler. So... you have all of these people and they are going throughout the South looking for Rogers. And this one guy, though, the Argentinian, he would pass the time in hotels by repeatedly stabbing his pillow with a knife. And he was incredibly racist, and I'm not even going to repeat what he used to say. But this is the kind of people that Lainey was hiring to go hunt somebody down and kill him. And then, hey, Robert, you want to come over and we can sleep together today or something? I mean, how she managed to keep all these balls in the air and juggling is crazy to me.
And yeah, she goes from sleeping with gun runners, cocaine smugglers, contract killers. And she's got quite the contact book. Kind of rivals Ghislaine's.
So then you've got the bodyguards hunting for Rogers. And then Lainey goes, hi, Roy. Do you know where Rogers was staying? Because remember, they had been partying for weeks, sharing essentially a hotel room and cocaine and hookers. And Raiden had told Lainey that he didn't know anything about the theft. But Lainey became more and more convinced that Raiden knew more than he was saying. And in a phone call said, you put him up to it. But... anyways, Lainey showed up at Raiden's hotel again, and this time she had Anna with her and was willing to bury the hatchet. Roy made another $2,500 purchase of cocaine from Lainey, who sold it to him at cost. And then he made a deep connection with Anna, apparently, who said, quote, he was a wonderful, caring man, and I loved him dearly. So that seems kind of interesting. So then he's got this kind of connection with Anna. But all of these bad things happening with Lainey. And next week, we are going to get to the cutting out of the movie deal. And I mean, there's just so much that goes on with this and the murder. And it never ends. And when you go back to the first couple lines of part one where, yeah, Lainey was just working at a law firm, just hour to hour, you know, making $3 an hour or something. And, you know, literally 6 or 7 short years later, she's sending hit squads to go kill guys, and she had been married 6 or 7 times. Lainey, you need to have a movie.
She does. She's a classic femme fatale. She learned a lot quick and certainly utilized it.
This case just, and just the swings and, you know, Roy Raden and all of these other people that go with him and this whole New York society and just this whole blackmail culture that was going on in New York and kept going on through New York. And let's not forget that Epstein was in New York. I mean, that's where he based his operations for the most part. And then you had Wexner and all of his ties to the mob with the Bartolo and all of that. And the mob, again, specializes in blackmail. these are the kind of things that they were running, and it's just this common thread that brings everybody kind of all together. Including, you know, Khashoggi, who I think, again, I'll say that I think Epstein kind of based what he wanted to be off of Adnan Khashoggi. And in many ways did exactly that. So, so it will be part three next week of this. And, I'm excited for it. Happy May to you, Jen. And, I hope that you have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you. I hope you do as well.
Okay. I will see you next week.
All right. Bye.
Bye.